Receiving. Transmission. Commence. Radio program. Sequence. Channel check.
Left channel. Right channel. Frequency check. Frequency check. Complete. All frequencies clear.
It's time, fearlessly, to go into the abyss. Into the world of the unknown, where fact and fiction collide.
The paradigm matrix.
A world where theories are abundant and the atmosphere of understanding is explored.
Are you listening?
It's time to drop that shroud of mystery and question what you think you know. It's time for The Paradigm Matrix.
The Paradigm Matrix.
And now your host and guide to the unknown, Willie Miranda.
And welcome to the Paradigm Matrix on this Friday night, January 31st, 2020, part of Fantopia Fridays with UFO Classifiers with Erica Lukes, Matt Maloney's Military X-Files, then followed up by Hyperspace with Solaren Blue Raven. This is the KCOR Digital Radio Network, The Core, and I'm your host, Willie Miranda. And before I go introduce my special guest tonight, I'd like to thank you, the listening audience, for your continued support and donations. We are listener-supported radio, and I'd like to thank my producer, Tina Marie, and my sponsor, TeamSquashersShoes.com. My guest tonight, Stephen Sekularius, has studied Eastern mysticism since 1973 and has a master's degree in counseling and human systems. In 1997, he began work on a documentary entitled In Another Life, Reincarnation in America, completing it over a five-year period. The program was broadcast on PBS affiliate KBDI in Denver, Colorado. In January of 2003, he was accepted for distribution to universities by Films Media Group. Stephen's website, launched to support the documentary project in 1998, provides an accurate information on reincarnation. In 2005, he became aware of a past life in the 19th century as author Matthew Franklin Whittier. And in 2009, he began researching the proposed match with the most rigorous methods available to an unfunded lay researcher. His two ebooks, Matthew Franklin Whittier in His Own Words, and a sequel, Matthew Whittier in His Own World, describe the research process and the results in a rigorous detail. The second book was written after moving from South Carolina to Maine, where he was in a position to visit scenes connected with Whittier's life. A third book in print entitled Reincarnation Can Be Proven was written to summarize his research in an entertaining, accessible way. Stephen lives in an attic studio apartment in historical Woodford's Corner neighborhood in Portland, Maine. Matthew Franklin Whittier lived in Portland for over 20 years. And I'd like to introduce my special guest tonight, Stephen. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for that introduction.
You're very welcome, and welcome to the Paradigm Matrix.
Yeah.
Stephen, evidence on reincarnation. I know that you have written this book regarding the evidence on reincarnation. What are your what are the biggest points of evidence that point to any evidence in reincarnation?
Well, of course, everybody starts out with Dr. Ian Stevenson and his colleagues at the University of Virginia, and he studied children who sometimes, just as soon as they could talk, would tell their parents, you know, you're not my real parents. I live in such and such a village, though my parents' names were such and such, and I want to go home, you know. And eventually they would bug their parents to the point where they would take them, and they'd know their way around. They'd know everybody there. They knew all kinds of secrets, like the fact that they'd carved their name on the back of the door or where the money was buried, or and they'd have talents that they used to have in their past life. And they even had birthmarks, which corresponded to the autopsy report from the past life where they'd been killed. And it goes on and on like that. And he has, well, about 250 extremely strong cases like that. None of them may be perfect, but as a whole, taken together, they're irrefutable evidence, I would say, at least of reincarnation. Personally, I think they're exceptional cases. I don't think they're typical. My suspicion is that those people didn't go through the normal process of going into the astral world or the Bardo realm and forgetting, you know, on the reentry, forgetting their past life and so on. I think a lot of them remained earthbound. There's a few that are, there's a different dynamic, I think, where they're so spiritually advanced that they remember their past lives. I think Shanti Devi was like that. I don't think Stevenson studied that one, but Gandhi did. So that's where you would start with Stevenson's work, but I'm not sure it's representative.
Now, in Stevenson's work, did he ever mention, or through your research, is there a correlation or a percentage where young children or infants, right, or let's say toddlers or young children would say that, okay, that you're not my parents or this is not my house, and opposed to adults that have come to the realization that, hey, wait a minute, why am I having these deja vus, or what do I remember this? What do I feel like I don't belong here, and this calls out to me? Is there a correlation between the two as far as, is it more common?
Well, it's very difficult to get numbers, first of all, because there's certain cultures where it's not acceptable. Even in India, it's supposed to be a bad sign. You know, it's bad luck.
Interesting.
Yeah, and in the United States, if you're in a Christian family, or even if it's not a Christian family, if it's a secular family, you know, you'll be crazy, and you'll be given drugs. And if it's a religious family, then that could be of the devil. And so there's not too many families where it's really acceptable. And the people that end up remembering are very often the people whose parents just respectfully listened. You know, correct. So they didn't get shut down. In other words.
It's somewhat taboo.
Yeah.
In a way.
It's taboo on both sides, the secular side and the religious side, both.
I'm very surprised with India, because I thought they'd be more open to this.
Well, they believe in it, but they don't want to hear it, because it's supposed to be bad luck. As I understand, according to some of Stevenson's literature, some of the parents would actually put the kid on a potter's wheel and spin them backwards, spin them counterclockwise, and that was supposed to, like, stop them. And it probably did. Stop them from talking about it anyway.
But I'm aware of all the research that you've done. I read an article, I would say maybe 10 years ago, that I stumbled on. This young child claimed that he was murdered. And, of course, he says, I was murdered. And I know who did it, and I can identify.
He fingered the murderer. Yeah,
You remember that?
Yeah, I do. I think there's been a couple like that. I don't remember the specifics, but I think the murderer was. I think he was charged in one case.
Wow.
Because yeah. I mean, the kid says, you know, my body is here, and they dug it up, and there it is. You know, so I mean.
Yeah. How are you going to explain that one?
Yeah.
How are you going to explain that one? Now, also. I believe 10 years ago, maybe more, there was a child that claimed that he was a World War II fighter pilot.
Yeah, James Leininger. Uh-huh.
Yes, and he can identify all the planes.
Yep, yeah, very strong. That was actually on primetime. That was originally Carol Bowman's case, and then Dr. Jim Tucker, who was the successor to Dr. Stevenson, took it up, and it ended up on primetime, which was like, you know, a major foray into the mass media. It's amazing. Very difficult to get a real reincarnation case into the mass media, but that one made it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, how are you going to explain that this young boy could recognize all these fighter planes? And of course, I believe he even mentioned the men that were in his fighter wing.
Yeah, he identified them. They were able to connect with his sister, I think, in that past life. And he knew the name of the ship, and he knew the name of some of his fellow sailors. And it's a very strong case, yeah. But he had nightmares. See, that's where instead of saying he wanted to go home, he was having nightmares of how he died.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of for the skeptic out there, this is, even if the parents or somebody did this research and of course, coached his kid, I mean, this kid was very believable.
Well, his parents were. I think his mother was Christian, and his father might have been a skeptic. You know, so they weren't really they weren't really ready to accept it. But what happened was he'd have these horrible screaming nightmares over and over. So finally, they had to do something.
Yeah, I did. I never saw the interviews on TV, but I believe I heard them on radio, and I heard the voice. I heard him in his own words, talking about the experience, and it was captivating.
Yeah, it's strong. As a matter of fact, on primetime, if you look at the reporter that goes out there and hangs out with the family and so on, he's looking kind of white in the face. Because he was like, oh my God, this is real, you know. You could see it.
I'm going to have to look that up.
It's on YouTube, so you can find it. And it's interesting. Yeah,
it's got to be. It's got to be. Well, even the radio interview, when I heard it on the radio, was very compelling.
Yeah. The problem is that children generally start to forget around age 7 or so. So a lot of these cases, once the kid hits around age 7, like if they're a teenager, they don't really remember it anymore.
Yes. But, you know, seeing a kid at that age and then, of course, describing those events, describing those planes, it's...
Yeah, he's like, I think he was 3 years old. It's in the show.
Yeah.
His mom takes him to a plane museum and, there's Corsairs. He knows the names of everything. And then his mother's talking to him like a 3 year old. And she says, look at the bomb on the bottom of that plane. And he says, that's not a bomb. That's a drop tank. He's like got the whole thing down. So it's very interesting. Yeah. Good case. Yeah. Soul Survivor is the name of their book.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look that up. That's awesome. Now, Stephen, the soul, and your thoughts, is the soul eternal?
Yeah, absolutely. From everything I've studied, the soul is eternal. My spiritual master, Meher Baba, talks about it in some depth, and he uses the analogy of the drop in the ocean. He says the soul is like a drop that's temporarily or seemingly separated from the ocean. But at the end of this whole process of reincarnation, eventually you realize yourself as the ocean. When the drop goes back into the ocean, there's no difference. You know, what's the difference between a drop in the ocean once it's back in? So, you know, that's the end result of all of this.
You know, I believe the same way. The soul's eternal. And there's no way of, we continue on. You know, we continue on the other side.
Yeah, well, it's, of course, now we're talking the astral body or the subtle body, which is the body that doesn't die. That's the body that makes you alive in your physical body. You're actually not living. Your physical body really is not alive, technically speaking. It's the astral body, the subtle body, that's always the one that's alive, and it enlivens the physical body. So as long as it's connected by that silver cord and through the chakras, as I understand it, your physical body is enlivened. And then once it separates, the physical body drops off and decays, and you're still in the same body that you've always been in, which is the subtle body.
Now, Stephen, as far as different cultures out there, can you name how many cultures really accept reincarnation? I know some of the American Indian cultures accept it, correct?
Yeah, I'm not an expert in that, but I will say they have some different ideas. You know, some of them believe that you reincarnate right away, like as soon as you take your last breath, you're, you know, getting born, which is not my understanding. There's some cultures that believe you can reincarnate as animals, which I also don't think is correct. So they may have a general belief in reincarnation, but here's the thing. I don't know how to express this exactly. Let's say you have an anthropologist, and he has a certain level of understanding. When he goes into a culture, it's like the law of attraction. He attracts to himself people in that other culture at his same level. So if he's ignorant, spiritually ignorant, he's going to connect with spiritually ignorant people in the culture he's studying. He's never going to see the guy that really knows. Does that make sense? So he's going to report back that this tribe of Indians believes such and such. Well, no, the guy that he was able to connect with believes that. You see what I'm saying? He never saw the guy up in the cave that really knows what's going on, see, because he wasn't at a level to be able to vibe with that person to connect with him. So it would take somebody like myself who studied for 45 years to go to that culture and find the guy in the cave that really knows, and then I would find out that, quote unquote, that culture actually has a much higher understanding of it.
Correct. Now, in your 45 years, what's been one of your favorite cases that you've read, you know, that they've really touched home?
I think my favorite one is Captain Robert Snow, because he was a professional investigator. He was the head of homicide investigation for the city of Indianapolis. And a coworker of his who used hypnosis for children dared him to have a past life hypnotic regression. And he's a skeptic, and he said, no way. He kept avoiding it. You know, this was like at a party. She said, why don't you have one of these? No, no, no. So she kept bugging him. Finally, he said, look, I got to shut this lady up. I'll go ahead and do it just to, you know, get her to shut up. So he goes into the office and he goes through the hypnotic induction. Nothing happens. Now, this is a guy that's strictly by the facts, by the book. So he's only going to say what he really experienced and nothing else, right? So he's sitting there and he says, my back hurt. You know, for half an hour, my back hurt in this chair and nothing's happening. All of a sudden, he's plunged into a complete 3D experience of being in a past life. You know, he's walking around in it. You know, the first one was like sort of a caveman kind of lifetime. And the next one was a virgin in a temple somewhere, like in prehistory, you know, at a temple priestess. And then he's in a lifetime as a painter, a minor painter in the early 1900s in America, James Carroll Beckwith. And this is somebody who can be researched. So when he came out of this thing, he says, I got to disprove this. You know, he's still not believing it. Okay. So he writes down 28 points that could be proved or disproved, you know. And then he digs and digs and digs and uses his professional abilities to research this thing. He finally finds James Carroll Beckwith's diary and scrapbook, and he goes through it, and he has to admit that he's proven every single one of those points. And he told me privately he actually proved the last two. So he actually proved all 30 points that could be proven, you know, and he had to believe it because, you know, he has to believe his own results. So that's a pretty strong case.
And of course, it really impacted him, of course, dramatically.
Well, I think he lost his job over it.
Oh, wow.
You know, so, yeah, it impacted him all right.
Wow.
He's writing books now, and he's not writing books about reincarnation. I think he might be redoing the one, Looking for Carol Beckwith, I think, is the title of it. I think he might be reissuing it, but mainly he's writing about things like terrorism and crime and stuff like that.
Of course. He's an author.
Yeah.
Of course. Now, have you had some interesting synchronicities?
Yeah, we talked about that before the show. I had some in the process of the early process of shooting my documentary. There's a fellow named Jeff Keane who has his own reincarnation case as the reincarnation of a Civil War general, John B. Gordon. And I met him to go around the Antietam battlefield where he had his flashback experience. So we're there. He's there because he's part of a Civil War tour, you know, a group of people that are going to go. I guess he doesn't tell them about reincarnation. He's just with this group. And we're standing in front of the hotel, and we're maybe 20 feet away from the entrance, and there's an older man and a younger man standing closer to the entrance. And I'm telling Jeff about Fidel O'Biddle, one of my ancestors who almost ended up fighting in that but got sick and wasn't able to. You know, whether he got sick because he was scared or whether he really got sick, I have no idea. But anyway, that's the family story. He got sick and he wasn't able to fight in it. So I'm telling Jeff this, and these two guys stop and they stare at me. And they must have been 20 feet away. And they come over and say, did you say Fidel O'Biddle? And I said, yeah. And I said, well, that's our ancestor.
No way.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I've never been up there. So, I mean, that's one of them. Then another one was that I was trying to find psychics to give a reading to Jeff Keane, and I was going to videotape it. This is way before anybody else was doing this except the spiritualist churches. Nobody else was videotaping live psychic readings, and I just got the idea myself. So I was calling this psychic school in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and I was trying to get hold of the head of it who had worked with Arthur Ford. She studied under Arthur Ford. And I got hold of this guy, Steve Smith. He was a teacher. And I didn't want to tell him why. You know, I just, you know, would talk to him. And we were both into like technical audio stuff. So we'd be talking about technical stuff. And finally, he asked me why I wanted to talk to her. And instead of, you know, I really shouldn't have said anything, but I did. I said, oh, I want to, somebody to read Jeff Keane because he's the reincarnation of John B. Gordon, a Civil War general. He says, John B. Gordon, that was my great-great uncle.
I'm not.
<You know? laughs> So things like that happen around Jeff. So anyway, there's more that happened in my own research, but we could talk about that later on when we get to my own case.
Oh, of course, you know, and of course, you know, reincarnation and how do you think the view is now in this day and age as far as reincarnation is concerned? You know, is it treated any different than, you know, the genre of today where, you know, like abductions, UFOs, cryptozoology?
Well, okay. I mean, every field has its own enthusiasts, you know, and reincarnation is no exception. But I have found that reincarnation is the last to be accepted. I mean, I think people are more likely to accept werewolves than reincarnation. I don't know why, you know. But I do have some ideas. Yeah, I mean, I don't know about flying pigs, but I haven't seen one, so I have to be open-minded. But no, I think partly because reincarnation, if you bring karma into it, it means absolute accountability. And since society became secularized and it got rid of heaven and hell for all the people except the Christians who are still, you know, adhering to that. But for this secular society, it got rid of this whole idea and it feels liberated. We don't have to worry about hell anymore. All of a sudden, here comes reincarnation and says you're 100% accountable for everything you do, and they don't want that, you know? So correct. That could be part.
And you know, a lot of times, reincarnation is just a belief. Not that I'm saying that it's belief, but it is a process where this is a lesson in life. You haven't gotten better, correct? So you reincarnate to be a better person.
Yeah, absolutely. Swami Vivekananda, who I've studied, said that life is a moral gymnasium, meaning each life one after another. It's a moral gymnasium. So it's a chance to develop character and to learn lessons. Yeah, that's what we're here for.
Now, has anyone else in your research has mentioned that as far as experiencing that?
Well, I mean, it's generally understood, but as far as the people who've studied their own lives, I mean, for example, Jenny Coquel in England, a lot of her motivation was that she wanted to find her children, because when she died, I think she had 9 children, if I remember correctly, and they were dispersed, you know, like to orphanages or family members or whatever, and they lost touch with each other, and she still had this drive to bring her children back. Shanti Devi had a very strong attachment to her past life husband and was disillusioned when she finally connected with him because he'd remarried, even though he promised he wouldn't. But, I mean, that was her motivation. In my case, I wanted to collect my past life literary legacy, which had been lost and stolen by other people, claimed by other people. So I think sometimes the people that research reincarnation have a particular axe to grind, you know, that brings them back.
Correct. And I believe a strong personal feeling, correct?
Yeah, in my case, it's very strong, yeah.
You know, a strong drive and probably something that really calls out to you.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and Jenny Coquel is a perfect example. She did bring back her living children to you know, meet each other and find each other again. She was successful.
Now, were they able to say the same for her?
Yeah, she brought them together, and at least one of them, Sunny, I think, was one of her children who did accept it. I mean, she definitely had their mother's memories. They didn't know how to explain it, you know.
Well, listen, we'll continue this fascinating conversation with Stephen Sekularius on The Paradigm Matrix. We'll be back after these commercial messages.
This is The Paradigm Matrix with Willie Miranda, where fact and fiction collide.
Go to your homes, stay in your home, and lock your doors. Above all, do not panic.
Come explore the unknown with us by calling 702-425-9230. That's 702-425-9230. Worldwide callers use Skype name KCOR Radio.
Call now.
There is a thin line between truth and deception. When the shift happens, will you be ready? Back after this.
The
Hello, KCOR listeners. Lorraine Fenton here from the Fenton Files to tell you about UFOCon 2020 in San Francisco, February 20th through 23rd. A conference like no other, UFOCon is where experiencers are going to reveal new information and science and consciousness will collide. So get your tickets at UFOCon2020.com. That's UFOCon2020.com. Don't miss what will be the most talked about conference of the decade.
What is the government hiding, and why? The truth hits the airwaves Friday night, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern, with Mac Maloney's Military X-Files.
That's the craziest thing I've ever heard.
Plunge deep into the paper trail of classified files. Unlock the secrets the government's been hiding for years. From UFOs to conspiracies, they've got you covered.
With us this morning in the KGFL studios is a local rancher who has a startling story to tell. You found something on your ranch? Some kind of debris?
This wasn't just any debris, sir. This was some metal like nothing I'd ever seen before. This was something from another world.
Mac Maloney's Military X-Files, hosted by Mac Maloney, Commander Cobra, and Juan Juan, along with regular correspondent Switchblade Steve Ward and Emily M. They go where no one else dares to go. Mac Maloney's Military X-Files, now airing Friday night, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern, on the KCOR Digital Radio Network.
At any given moment, your ability to keep your mouth shut, and if necessary, to lie through your teeth, may very well determine the course of history.
They know what's really out there. Shouldn't you?
KCOR Las Vegas.
All the time.
Of course I listen.
I listen all day.
It's the best music.
KCOR, the new underground source for news, talk, and music at KCORradio.com. Tell your friends, email them, or Facebook them, or Twitter them.
Hey, are we done here? Because I'm losing my buzz.
Now, broadcasting in digital HD radio.
Friday night, 9 p.m. Pacific. Jump onto the celestial highway and travel at the speed of light. Into hyperspace.
Hyperspace.
Hyperspace. Hyperspace. Hosted by Solaris Blue Raven. She navigates you through the cosmic tides of mysticism into the world of covert technology, UFOs, mystical sciences, and the world of unforeseen forces.
You get to really sort of enjoy a bizarre ride.
Listen live, Friday night, 9 p.m. Pacific.
For Hyperspace.
The one show that blows the whistle off our government black ops projects. Hyperspace. Hosted by Solaris Blue Raven.
Solaris Blue Raven.
Exclusively on the KCOR Digital Radio Network.
Wanna take a ride?
Take a ride.
Take a ride.
Choose, and choose wisely.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Welcome back to the Paradigm Matrix.
The Paradigm Matrix.
Where fact and fiction collide.
Prepare yourselves.
Join the show by calling 702-425-9230. That's 702-425-9230. Those around the world use Skype name KCOR Radio.
Call now.
Tweet your thoughts anytime by using hashtag KCOR at KCOR Radio. Escape the Matrix and join the conversation live in our chat room at KCORradio.com.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
And now your host of the Paradigm Matrix, Willie Miranda.
Willie Miranda.
And welcome back to the Paradigm Matrix with my special guest, Stephen Sakellarius. And Stephen, your own experience with reincarnation.
Yeah, you know, I had studied the best cases when I that I could possibly find when I produced my documentary. It took me 5 years, and in that 5 years, I learned about Captain Snow and Jenny Coquel and Dr. Stevenson and Peter Ramster, an Australian psychologist that used hypnosis. Lots of strong cases, and then I stumbled on one of my own. In 2005, I stumbled on Matthew Franklin Whittier, the younger brother of Quaker poet John Greenleaf Whittier in the 19th century. And I was looking at this etching of him, and when I looked into the eyes, I said, that's me. You know, absolutely, that's myself. I could feel it. So that was 2005. I kind of poked around a little bit for 4 years. And in 2009, I connected with a woman right next door to Matthew's hometown by accident. I didn't know she lived there. And she was a skeptic, but she agreed to research it with me. And what she would do is she would send me information, and then I would react to it and tell her what my reactions were. I made sure that everything was dated in emails. And that way, you know, I could say that I had this past life impression. And then later on, I was able to prove it in the historical record. So I could, you know, always had a record of what came first. And I went from there.
Now, can you describe to me that feeling, you know, when you saw that picture?
Well, the best way I can describe it is, and I have another younger picture of him. This is a three-quarter view. The younger picture is looking straight into the camera. When I look at those pictures into the eyes, I feel like there's nothing in the way, is the way I would put it. I'm pretty intuitive. If I look at a portrait or look into anyone's eyes, I can feel their personality. There's something that's not me that's kind of in the way, that's not like me, you know, it's a difference. And I can feel that. When I look at these portraits, there's none of that. It's just, I'm just looking straight through into my own soul. There's absolutely nothing blocking it. That's the best way I can describe it. It's a subjective kind of thing. Hmm. It's the only thing I can compare it to is that you would use your own toothbrush, but you wouldn't use anybody else's toothbrush, you know? Or if you spit into the water, you still probably could drink it, but not if anybody else did, you know? So,
correct.
I mean, I feel that when I look at those portraits as opposed to a portrait of anybody else, even somebody that looks similar.
So it's a very strong identification.
Yeah.
As far as, now, did you have any inkling or an idea or a, let's say, a deja vu before 2005 of any of this?
I did, in a sense. Now, in 2003, when I released my documentary, I did an interview. I don't have the text up in front of me to read it, but I can paraphrase it. She asked me, this was an emailed interview, so she emailed me the questions, I emailed the answers back, and one of them was, do you remember any of your past lives, which took me a little bit off guard. I wasn't expecting that, but I went ahead and answered it, and I'd always had some feelings about it, you know, nothing I've ever proven at that point, but I said that I thought I'd been one of the romantic writers, one of the romantic poets, and not one of the famous ones, but I felt like I was in that circle on the periphery of those people, and that I knew them, you know. And that's a description of Matthew. That was 2 years before I stumbled on his picture. And I wasn't looking for that, you know, mm-hmm. when I found it. I'd forgotten completely, you know, about that. So yeah, I did predict it in a sense, yeah.
Now, as far as, let's say, writing styles, okay, did you find yourself also maybe writing like him? Before 2005.
Yeah, I have samples.
You were writing this way.
Well, he wrote in a few different styles. Okay. He wrote, but when you're talking about serious intellectual, you know, essays, yeah, I'm very close, and I actually made some of the same points that he did. I mean, not just style, but actual philosophical opinions, you know, are the same. And he also was a satirist, and I had that in me, but I wrote that privately, but I didn't really write that so much publicly. But when I was in sixth grade, I was a member. I was actually the head of a little group called the Odors, and mm-hmm. and our whole thing was to be as sarcastic and put everything down as much as we possibly could, you know? So, I mean, I was feeling Matthew and myself basically at sixth grade, about age 12. So there's a lot of parallels.
So you must have gone, huh?
But when I found Matthew, I knew, I knew exactly what he was about. Here's the thing. When I first saw his writings, like a few examples of some of his humorous writings, I immediately had the thought, oh, he used to embed secrets about his own personal life in these silly stories, you know, and it turned out to be absolutely true. There was no way I would have known that normally.
It's fascinating. Now, we do have a question on the chat line. It's by Ken. Ken, thank you very much for your question. And Ken is asking, do people have past life dreams?
Yeah, they do. I haven't had so many. There's one that might have been a past life dream that I had many years ago, but other people have had them. Well, for example, that little boy, James Leininger, he was remembering in his dreams, he was remembering crashing in a fighter plane, you know, and he would be screaming, little man on fire, can't get out, you know. Oh. So, yeah, definitely dreams, past lives. And what usually happens is they're vivid, they're repeated, and they're always the same. So those are like signs that it could be a past life dream.
Well, it sounds traumatizing too.
Well, it can be. Not necessarily. Some of them can be good. You know, if it's emotional, that's the thing. If it's emotion, the emotion will bring it through.
Now, got another question for you, Stephen, and it came through this Skype. Samantha, thank you very much, Samantha, for your question. And it says, if you were a killer in your past life, could that come back and you repeat being a killer in your new life?
Anything that you do like that, you'll have a tendency, like a repetition compulsion. That goes for eating and alcohol and killing people and everything else, because the mental impressions that are left in your unconscious mind. But what'll happen, I'm going by the teachings of my guru, Meher Baba now. He says that you will unconsciously gravitate towards situations where you'll get the opposite. So in that case, you would gravitate towards situations where you'll be killed, and that will balance it out and stop that repetition compulsion. So,
you know, okay. You know, and that was a fascinating question, and it just had me thinking, do you believe that any of these serial killers from present day were killers in their past life?
I think they were, but I also think they're being influenced. Hold on a second. Yeah. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Had a little Skype issue. Okay. I think they're being influenced by earthbound spirits or other spirits. So they spirits on the other side that have these kind of impressions, if they're earthbound, they will be drawn to people that have similar impressions. So they'll magnify whatever the person already has in their nature. They'll make it worse. So instead of just killing somebody once, they may kill over and over, or they may kill a whole bunch of people. I think these mass shootings are partly possession influenced.
I agree. I definitely agree. Yeah. Now, Stephen, you're familiar with General George Patton?
Yeah.
And he believed, also in reincarnation, he believed that in some of these battles, he was in them.
That's right. Yeah, he pointed them out to people. He said, I was here, you know. Yeah.
Amazing. You know, I'm pretty sure that he wrote that in his memoirs.
I've read about him. I haven't read his own memoirs directly, so I think so, yeah.
I'm pretty sure, but he was a strong believer. Mm-hmm. For sure. Now, going back to your reincarnation experience and also the feelings, I know that he lived in Maine, mm-hmm. of course, and now that you're back in Maine, is there anywhere particular where something reminds you?
Yeah, okay. There are. There's places where I know that he was, but here's the thing, what I found is that just speaking for myself, if I'm going to have a flashback, there's two things that have to be there in order for that to happen. It's not definitely going to happen, but in order for it to be likely, there has to be strong emotion, and whatever I'm looking at has to be pretty much the same as it was. So we're talking a portrait or a building. So there's places I can go to. Portland had a huge fire in 1866. A lot of things got wiped out. So I can go to the exact spot where I knew that I lived, but just being there in the coordinates doesn't do anything, you know?
And, it's, And have you said to yourself, I know this place was here, and you have to go maybe go to a library or ask someone or go to a historical society and find out if this was there?
Yeah, yeah. I know it. I know he was there, but so there's nothing there now, and there's nothing to trigger it. Correct. But on the other hand, if I go to a place where it's the way it was and there's emotion attached to it, I can have a flashback. And then a flashback is just a brief little glimpse, you know, that always stays the same. And then the question is it something I can prove? You know, and that's tricky. It's not easy to prove these things. So I'll give you an example of one I can't prove. Right where I live, near Woodford's Corner, there's a hill that goes up on Brighton Avenue, and I take walks out there. When I saw that, I'm walking towards it, and it's just the shape of the hill. I had a flashback that myself and my first wife in that lifetime, Abby, who was my true love, that when we lived in Portland, we would take a ride out to the country. And we would have to go up that hill, and it was so steep that we would get out and let the horse, you know, ride, you know, let the horse go up without pulling us to take a little strain off the horse. And it was kind of a nervous thing, you know. I remember trying to make light of it, to make fun of it, so that Abby wouldn't be nervous, because we'd have to hop out, you know, and walk up this hill, and it was kind of a big deal. So I would, you know, kind of make fun of it so she wouldn't be too nervous about it. But it was a joyous thing because we were on our, the feeling, you know, because we're on our way for a day in the country and I'm with her and, you know, it's a wonderful feeling. And I get the same vague sense every time I see that hill, but I can never get any more and I can't prove it.
It's a personal happy moment.
Yeah. Yeah. So it can be strong, either positive or negative. It doesn't have to be negative.
Now, Stephen, has a smell triggered anything?
Yeah, the you know, I have a lot of antiquarian books and old newspapers from the era, and that smell of that paper is very strong, and it the emotion comes through. I haven't gotten like cognitive memories of, oh, I remember I was in such and such a city, you know, or such and such a building, or what the date was. I don't get that, but I would definitely, the smell of that paper is very strong for me, and I start feeling what it was like then.
That's so interesting. Now, I got another question from Paige Regis. Thank you, Paige, for the question. And are there ways to help remember our past lives?
Yeah, of course, you have to ask the question if you should, which I won't go into, you know, now for lack of time. But supposing you decide that you should, because there are some drawbacks to it. Of course, there's hypnotic regression, so that's obvious. There's non-hypnotic regression. If you look up the people that continue in the footsteps of the late Roger Wolger, the Netherton method, there's that. There's a number of other things you can look at. Here's what I would do in terms of my method. If I had to start over and I didn't have any past life that I stumbled on, and I had money, because this is going to take money, I'd have 6 psychic readings with genuine psychics. And then I would have 6 past life regressions with a good hypnotist. And then I would look at that and see if there's commonalities. Because I had 2 psychic readings, mediums that connected me with Abby, Matthew's first wife. And there was cross correspondences just in those 2. Because, for example, they both said how far ahead of our time we were. And they both mentioned how intelligent Abby was, and something of her personality and so on came through in both of them. So if you had 6 real psychics, you're going to see some cross correspondences, and you may be able to actually find that lifetime that way.
Now, as far as Abby is concerned, has anybody out there claimed to be Abby or suspect to be Abby?
Well, she's in the astral world, so she's not here physically. Yeah. So I've made contact with her through these mediums and have maintained contact with her on the other side. But there's been at least one person. There was one friend of mine who helped find her portrait for me, who said, you know, Abby came to me in a dream last night. And I when I woke up from that dream, I absolutely knew 100% that she's real, you know. But she's only done it with that one person.
Well, and this was in the 19th century, early 19th century, correct?
Yeah, yeah. They married in 1836. They eloped, and she died of consumption in March of 1841.
Well, so right into the Victorian, right around the Victorian era, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Correct. Now, when you saw the picture, what emotions did that trigger?
Well, here's the thing. I had seen a photograph, a daguerreotype, of a woman that I thought was Abby for some time, and it turned out it couldn't possibly have been. And I figured out it was probably a girl that reminded Matthew of Abby that he had an affair with or a relationship with some years later. So there was a real memory attached to her, I think. He's not identified, you know, but it wasn't her. So I was very gun shy about that. So when I found Abby's actual portrait, I was afraid to commit. I felt it, you know, I definitely felt it, but I was afraid to, you know, to say definitely Correct. That I thought it was. Yeah. Finally, I was able to prove it through a whole bunch of like circumstantial evidence.
Now, as far as deja vus are concerned, Stephen, are those a trigger or a telltale sign you have any past life?
I think so. I don't know if that's the only explanation for them. Some of them can be prescience, you know. Some of them can be, you know, something that you are, you know, going to experience, you know, or that you had. In other words, you had a prescient awareness before, and then when you hit it again, it's like, wait a minute, I saw this before, you know.
Correct.
So that
you
could be, but it could also be past life, you know.
Correct, because at times, you know, we all experience them, but there are some that are stronger than others.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem so, it's like, the way I can describe it, it's like having a bucket of ice water thrown to you, you know, it's like, whoa, you know?
Well, I'll tell you another example for myself. I went to the Portland Head Light here, which is actually in Cape Elizabeth. So yes. a famous lighthouse.
Correct.
And going to the lighthouse, I didn't really feel anything. But then I walked to the left of it, facing the ocean. It's on my right. And I walked to the left, maybe, you know, 300 feet or something like that. And right then, it was something about being in that position and looking out and seeing the little island that was there, you know, and I suddenly had a flash. And it was very emotional. And I remembered two things. I remembered grieving for Abby, but I remembered before that we had stood there. And I remembered that, you know, I had my arm around her. She was very much shorter than I was. And she would say kind of Victorian sort of things like, I'm small and you are tall, you know, like a humble sort of thing, you know, mm-hmm. like a joke. I am small and you are tall. And she would joke about it. But there's a rock down there, kind of maybe 10 feet across that sticks up. And I looked at that and I said, she told me that if I pass on, if you are as persevering, as solid as that rock, that the day will come around when we'll be together again. And I remembered that. And after she died, I would stand there and look at that rock and say, I'm going to be like that rock, you know. And I was managing these terrible emotions, you know, of grief, tumultuous. And I would stare at that rock and kind of hang on to it and say, I'm going to be like that rock. You know, and that all came to me just from standing, being exactly in the right angle there, you know. So, I mean, you can call that a deja vu. I don't know, but it was strong, you know. And I have no way to prove that, though, because it's not anywhere in any letters or anything, you know.
Well, it also says that love also transcends.
Transcends everything. Yeah.
Transcends everything.
Yeah,
it really does.
Because it's experienced in a timeless space. So
Correct.
I really believe that. That's what I feel. There's a couple experiences that I remember with Abby, which were just absolutely timeless. It's like they're still happening because we hit a space that was eternal, you know?
Correct. When we first spoke, I had mentioned to you, and we were talking a little bit about that. We had mentioned to you about the movie, a particular movie in the early 80s. I believe it was Somewhere in Time, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was Christopher Reeves and
yes.
I believe it was Jane Seymour. And he had fallen in love with this woman in the portrait. And I believe he felt like he was there. And I guess he put himself into a trance and basically went back in time.
Went back, yeah.
Yeah, correct. And it was such a fascinating, it's one of my all-time favorites when it comes to that type of.
Well, it's impossible, and yet there's a truth in it. You know, you feel it. That there's something true about this, you know, even though it's an impossible plot, and yet, you know, yeah.
Correct. And I mentioned to you about when he pulled that penny out of his vest, and it said 1979 or something, and it just brought him back to,
yeah.
it brought him back to reality, mm. you know, to the present time, and he was just so desperate to get back. I need to ask you: is there times that you want to be back, you know, And that
well,
time,
I'll tell you what I really want is to go back and save Abby. That's the thing. The overriding thing is I want to go back and save her. What could I have done different? And you'll see this in the mediums, when the mediums read people and they wish they could do it over and somehow they could save the person. You know, well, I still have that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Those feelings. Yeah. Now, I want to talk about a little bit about your e-books, okay? And where can we get the where can we get the books?
Well, it's all available on the website, through the website, and it's www.ial, for In Another Life, ial.goldthread.com, goldthread.com. So you'll see the navigation bar on the left. It says books, and just click on that, and the links and the descriptions are all there. These e-books are really my research. It's about the story of my research, but the research went on for 10 years, and I kept adding to these books because I kept finding new information. So they're huge. They're absolutely huge, but you don't have to read the whole thing. You know, you can definitely get your money's worth by, you know, by skipping through them. If you want to read the whole thing, you're talking maybe, you know, 3 weeks you know, to get through them. They're very long, but they're interesting. You know, I've got it broken up into little subchapters and, you know, I mean, it's if you like detective work, there's some, you know, serious detective work involved there.
Now, the documentary that is entitled In Another Life, Reincarnation in America, how is that is that available?
That's available on the navigation bar on the left. It says videos. You just click on videos and you'll see that as one of the choices. It's free. It's on YouTube. Yeah.
Fantastic. Now, the Parafest in Maine. You're going to be speaking
there. I'm the first speaker. I'm going to blow some people away because I'm going to talk about Matthew and the things I found out about his life personally and the Whittier family personally. And it's things that nobody's ever seen in that, you know, in that legacy. Or, you know, I'm going to tell Matthew's side of the story, and it's very different than what, you know, the historians say. So, and I'm going to bring in past life memory with it, you know, but I mean, I'm really going to focus on that, and I hope it's going to be kind of an eye opener. It may, hopefully nobody will bring any eggs or tomatoes.
Oh, no, not at all. Not
the Whittier fans, you know, because it's not, you know, it's a very different take on him. And he's, you know, his brother's quite famous here in New England. So, but there's a lot of past life memory in it also.
Now, as far as the event is concerned, it's going to be in
Kittery.
Kittery, Maine.
Yeah, April 3rd. Yeah.
And you're going to be the first speaker, right?
That's where they put me at the top of it. I think because of this angle, because they're hoping that, you know, the living, breathing brother of John Greenleaf Whittier may be a draw, I think.
Okay. Well, listen, Stephen, it was such a pleasure to have you in the Paradigm Matrix.
Great opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and hope for you to come back. Now, stay tuned for Matt Maloney's Military X-Files, followed up by Hyperspace with Solaris Blue Raven, and her special guest, Mr. Stephen Bassett. This is William Miranda, Paradigm Matrix, and we'll see you all next week.
In a world of deceptions and false narratives, one show, one voice speaks the truth.
The most baffling mystery that still plagues the authorities is...
The Paradigm Matrix.
Paradigm Matrix.
Hosted by Willie Miranda. Exclusively on the KCOR Digital Radio Network. Every Friday night, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. For more information on the show, host, and upcoming guests, please visit the Paradigm Matrix show page at kcorradio.com. The Paradigm Matrix.
Paradigm Matrix.
This is where we live!
Where fact and fiction collide. This is KCOR Las Vegas, home of the Digital Radio Network, broadcasting from a shack just south of Area 51.
Wait, that doesn't exist.
This is the KCOR Digital Radio Network. Now for the news.